What's up, everybody, and welcome to M&M Chat, the show where I interview my friends and some occasionally popular people if I can get them on, and give people a space to nerd out, talk about themselves, tell us how they got into Dungeons & Dragons or TTRPGs in general, and just overall have a conversation. So today I am lucky enough to be joined by one of my friends, and definitely not one of those semi-interesting people that I know, Sam from World Forge Podcast. Sam, introduce yourself, whatever you want to say. I am, despite the antagonizing that I'm sure we'll have back and forth, really happy to have you on. Yeah. So please, introduce yourself.
Hey, Jared, happy to be on here. I really appreciate you clarifying right off the top which of the two that I was, the friend or a interesting popular person, because I was going to be wondering the whole episode otherwise. I am Sam. I'm one half of the World Forge podcast. My fiance and I host this little show of ours where we take random prompts from our listeners, from our own minds, from, you know, media all over the place. We use them to create characters, monsters, adventures, stories for D&D games, TTRPGs, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's a fun little weekly show we've had going on for a couple of years now. And that's kind of who I am, at least as far as the internet is concerned.
And I've actually, I found you and met you through Twitter because of World Forge Podcast, as you were one of the first other non-actual play podcasts about tabletops that I found when we had started. So immediately I was like, gotta latch on to them. They're doing something interesting. And accidentally I became a fan from that. So
despite your best efforts.
And you know, throughout that time, I've listened to a lot of you and Piper, and you guys have helped me a lot with my approach to world building. Which I've greatly appreciated, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, and one of the reasons I shout you guys out anytime I get the opportunity. But what I've realized is I've never really heard anything about the personal world that you have created. So when you have a show that's dedicated to world building, you'd expect that to be like forefront of the topic. So I'm sure we'll get into some of that. Where I want to start today is just talk to me to start about how you really got into Dungeons & Dragons or tabletops in general.
Yeah, I first off, actually, I want to say thank you. That's just really nice to hear that, I don't know, that we have any kind of impact on our listeners really means a lot to us. Like, I think that this is really something that we view as this really silly, self-indulgent thing we do, so that, you know, Piper and I like to just run our mouths for, you know, an hour to 2 hours every single week. And the fact that it's actually helped make people's tabletop role play lives easier really means a lot to us. I think in another way, I do see the show as, you know, now that we get this feedback from people on occasion, and it's always this sort of mind blowing thing. And I think we sort of carry forward in the show is this, you know, this idea of like trying to pay that forward, right? Because that's kind of how I got into D&D myself, is that, you know, I had a friend of mine who was really into it, and he sort of taught me his method of playing the game and of creating worlds and of creating characters. And, you know, that's something that throughout the, you know, 20 years or so that I've been playing, it's just been evolving and growing and changing. And a lot of that is based on the other people that I've gotten to play with and the other people who's, you know, who's podcasts I've listened to and whose D&D actual play, you know, like YouTube shows and things like that that I've listened to. So I feel very honored to get to be included in that sort of pantheon of people. It was actually a elementary school friend of mine who he got
really
the,
young.
Yeah, real young. He got the third edition book. It would have been right after third edition came out, actually. I think it would have, like early 2000s. His stepdad had played D&D when he was younger, and so he got him really into it, and he was really, really excited to get a group of friends together and go play. I mean, it was kind of this classic story, you know, of us ending up hanging out in his garage, all poring through these rule books and seeing who could come up with the coolest character and who could, you know, slay the most dragons. And, you know, we had these really grand ideas that, you know, now looking back, I mean, I still have all my notebooks from those days when I was a kid of all the characters I did and all the adventures that I got into, which is actually maybe something we should revisit on air sometime now that I think about it. But you know, I look back at those and I think it's so funny to see how much that's changed, right? right. to see the crude tools that I was able to bring to bear back then, and you know, and the ways that that I tell stories differently now, and the ways that I create characters differently now. But I'm really thankful to have had that friend. You know, he introduced me and a few other of our close friends to it, and we just never really let it go. I was actually kind of a holdout for third edition for a long time, well into I basically just skipped over fourth edition entirely, and well into fifth edition I still play actually kind of like a modified edition that has a little more crunch to it. We have a few house rules that let me do all of that math that I so crave.
And have you just like roped in all of your friends at the table? Just like, yeah, we're playing this way. Like they're all on the same page. Or is it like, depending on the DM, playing it a different way?
Yeah. You know, it does definitely depend on the groups that I play with. Right now, I think I have like four kind of, I want to say like long running groups going on right now. Yeah. You know, we don't meet every week by any means. Depending on who I'm playing with, you know, you kind of have to read the room, right? I have groups that really do like the math and that mm-hmm. like to play a much more, I guess, what I would consider kind of a holistic version of the game, right? With a more of an emphasis on numbers, right? And we have other groups that are just about telling a story and that are much more collaborative and are about everybody kind of agreeing on what would be interesting to happen and putting less reliance on the dice rolls and more reliance on just the fun stories we want to tell and the fun characters we want to play. And those are actually, I think that's been one of the biggest changes in my career as a D&D player and as a DM, is this sort of shift towards the role play side of things and to the sort of softer, more talky side of D&D. I mean, we always would get into the role play, but it was always sort of role play facilitated by dice rolls. And now I think I see the way I play much more as dice rolls facilitated by role play. Right. And I, you know, we try as much as we can to make sure that it's not just one person telling a story and everybody else listening. Whether I'm a DM or a player, I love to get feedback from the players that are kind of playing under me, or, you know, to have a hand in that story. And that's something that we really try to encourage in all of our games, even the crunchier ones.
Yeah, love that. So, you know, you started super young and moved on to DMing at some point, I assume. Yeah. So when did that happen? What was that like, going from an elementary school kid just, you know, screwing around making characters to actually running the game?
I mean, I'm like a true forever DM, honestly. Since day one, I had a really heavy interest in it. I love getting to build, right? I love getting to say, I created this thing, you know, look ye mighty and despair upon what I have created, right? Like, that's really exciting to me. I right away took to DMing, I think, more so than I took to playing. And I ended up kind of getting stuck in that pattern, I think, for a little while, where when I did want to play, everybody's like, well, Sam, you always DM and you've got ideas waiting to be explored. And I'm like, okay, whatever.
You're like, I've got player ideas too, yeah, guys. Yeah. This is a two-way street.
Exactly. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was always kind of a creative kid. I mean, I did theater when I was younger, and I was always more artistic, I think, than anything else. And so I really just settled very naturally into that. Yeah, that's always been really rewarding for me. I don't know what it is that caused that in me. I don't know. That's just the way I've always been.
I totally get it. Ever since I started DMing, it was very difficult to pull away from it. And as much as I, you know, want to explore some characters and all of that, it's like DMing is where it's at for me.
And in a lot of ways, as a DM, as a player, you're limited to the one character, right? As a DM, you have the opportunity to play 50 different characters every time you sit down at the table, right? I mean,
right.
If you know, my I'm one of those people that as soon as I, you know, lay down to go to sleep at night, my brain turns on. You know, I've got 50 ideas going through my head all the time. I don't know if you've read the Kingkiller Chronicles at all, but he always talks about to perform magic, you have to, you know, like concentrate on your spell, right? So you split your mind in two, and there's the active sort of waking part of your mind that is the part I'm using right now to communicate with you, to sort of speak actively and interact with the world. And then there's the second part of your mind that you you know, steer towards accomplishing, you know, these magical goals, that they maintain all your spells and they maintain your focus. And that part of your mind needs to be as strong as, you know, worked steel, basically. And so there's always this kind of secondary part of my mind that I just don't know how to turn off. That's always work, you know, thinking of another character or another. So I sort of like getting to say, all right, I'm playing this character now. What's up? Who's on deck, right? Who's coming up next? So that's sort of the way that I view DMing. I mean, maybe that's like I've kind of given myself Stockholm syndrome as being stuck as a DM forever, and I'm just justifying this trap that I've put myself in. But you know, I do like to think of, you know, playing being a DM as getting to play, you know, an entire world of characters all at once.
Yeah, I 100% get that, and I think that one of my limitations with playing a character, like a specific one character, is that a lot of times I have this really great idea, then you play it, and then after like a little bit, you're like, you know, that didn't really work out too well. As a DM, you're just like, oh yeah, just change it. And then you know, you find new characters that you love out of ones you might not have thought of.
Yeah, when you get bored of a character as a player, it sucks a lot more than when you get bored of a character as a DM. You know, as a DM, you can just say, oh, he got hit by a meteor, he's dead, what do you want? Like, you know. As a player, you know, you think, well, if everybody else is having fun, I'm stuck with this idiot. You know, I gotta play it a couple other sessions.
It really speaks a lot that you chose, I'm stuck with this idiot, because that idiot is in a way you. You're stuck with your own idiot.
not in a way. That's generous of you. Not just the one way.
So then, you know, you go right into DMing really early on. You say you're super creative. Were you making up your own worlds right away? Or was it like not even an idea? You were just kind of playing in a miscellaneous area, pre-made modules? Like what started you on DMing?
Yeah. You know what's funny? I've actually never run a pre-made module. I feel a little bit self-conscious about that sometimes, right? Like I don't have authority to talk about D&D in the way that some other DMs might, right? Because I've certainly stolen ideas from pre-made modules, and I've adapted ideas from pre-made modules. That's kind of like a motto of our show, is that, you know, if you can steal and get away with it, then, you know, that's one of the best ways to create. Like nothing is really original anymore, right? Everything we do is stolen from somewhere. I think when I started playing, I had a much sort of stricter idea about how you kind of build a world, right? Like you have to plan all these things out in advance. You have you have to decide who the pantheon of gods is. You have to know who all the major players in all the major cities are. You have to know all these places that you can go, right? And so I would spend all this time, you know, I'd have, you know, Word documents or notebooks or whatever of all these lists of places you could go. And I'd randomly generate all these names and traits and things like that. And I'd kind of piece them together like a puzzle a little bit. And I think now I've moved more towards a style of world building where I like to sort of build a little nest, right? And then I lay a couple of big juicy eggs in that nest, right? I plant the seeds of this world, and then I let them hatch and fly off and do their own thing, right?
Right.
Is that a really gross metaphor for me to talk about laying eggs?
I think it was the big juicy part that got
the big
me.
Juicy eggs, yeah.
You said, I lay an egg in my nest. Okay, I'm with you. I lay a big, juicy egg.
Oh, yeah. All right. It's a real, real chungus of an egg. I think this way, all my players get to take turns sitting on the egg, and then whatever hatches from it is something that's kind of born from all of our minds, right? Like,
sure.
And it gives everybody more freedom. I certainly will have an idea of where I want things to go and what I want the world to be like. And, you know, I'll do a lot of work to establish a tone and kind of a feel for the world, right? I like to try and engage all the senses when I do that. I think, what does this world smell like? What does it sound like? What does it look like? What is it, you know, what does it taste like? And there's so many great tools out there to help you with that too. You know, we have all these like soundscape tools that can give you sort of ambient experiences. You know, you can light candles, you can dim the lights, you can do all these different things while you play. But then from there, the events that happen in the world, I've really moved away, especially in the last couple of years since Piper and I started playing together. I've really moved away from putting too many happenings in my world without my players' input. You know, I like to have one sort of catalyzing event that will kick everything off. And of course, there's, you know, there's history that leads up to it, but I want my players to have room to say, you know, 10 sessions in, hey, hold on, flashback. 20 years ago, I was part of this war and I was a part of this main battle. And, you know, this is what led up to this. You know, I think that's kind of a fun thing. We're constantly enriching the world in every direction. We're not just building into the future, we're building into the past as well. And I think that gives us all, you know, stronger tools to build with, right? So,
sure.
I guess that's sort of how I benefit now from not having as strict of a plan going into world building is, one, it's a lot less work in a lot of ways,
right.
But two, I get to have my players help me shoulder that burden. Like, you know, that's a really nice benefit, but also I think you genuinely get better material when you are building collaboratively, when your players have the freedom to be a part of the world and not just follow the sort of path that you put them on.
Right. So then it sounds like to me, you're almost making a different world for like every campaign. Like when you start a new thing, you're like, let's start over fresh every time. Is that right? Or do you have like anything consistent?
Yeah. You know, I have a few. So I have one, the campaign that I'm probably going to talk the most about today is this one big persistent world that I've had running for about 8 years now. And this world has actually survived multiple D&D groups. It was with one group that I originally built it for, multiple groups and multiple editions of D&D actually. So there's been major revisions to this over the years.
Sure.
I designed this for one group that I was in, and there was a, you know, this group separated. We don't, you know, play together anymore. And I said, shit, man, I put a lot of work into building this. I don't want to just throw this away, right? So I waited a little while. I kind of reworked some things. I took what I liked about the experiences that we had had in that world, and I kept those, and I kind of threw out everything that didn't work, and then I created a new sort of blank slate. And that's the main world that I've had that's gone across. I've kind of play tested it with one group, and then I actually played with another, and now we're on sort of the third iteration of that world in the group that I'm in now. And now we've been playing it for, you know, 6 years or something like that. But outside of that campaign, I would say I don't really think about it that much, right? Like, I think it's a lot to have too many big, persistent, like, universes going on in my mind at once. Like, I would never be able to keep that straight, right? So, you know, there will be things that carry over from one campaign to the next or one D&D group to the next, but I actually think it's sort of fun to not really necessarily put a pin in whether or not it is the same world. You know, maybe there are going to be like similar names. There's going to be commonalities between these worlds, right? And my players can maybe guess at it, and they can sort of, if one of them says, hold on a minute, is this the thing from the other campaign? I might go, yeah, hell yeah. Sure, it's the same world. That sounds great. That sounds like a lot of fun. But if they're not really picking up on it, then, you know, I can't be bothered to try and keep all that straight every single time. So I think I like to have that ability to sort of jump in and out of being tied to this past history that can sometimes make our stories better, but also not really being shackled to it to the point where we have to kind of bend to its will a little bit. So I don't know. I think I've maybe written myself a couple of into an easier position as a storyteller there, right? I can, you know, I'm cheating essentially. Like, I can take all of the benefits of having one big persistent world, but I don't actually have to face any of the penalties or do any of the work to put that in place.
Sure, sure. And say, as long as you're, especially if you're playing with different people, then it's extremely easy, as you're the only person who has to keep any of it straight, if you even want to at all.
Exactly.
Because players don't remember anything.
Totally. Piper doesn't remember my name sometimes, like my real life name. Like, she's not going to remember whether or not, you know, Paylor or Saloon were the primary deities of this world. You know what I mean? Like,
take notes, everyone. This is the foundation of a strong relationship. First step, have a podcast together. Step two, forget each other's names and interests.
Well, we have had a podcast together longer than we've been engaged. So, yeah, I mean, that is a pretty important foundational step, I think. Yeah.
There you go. So what's the name of this consistent world you've got?
So, as you know, Jared, as a listener of our podcast, I love naming things. Not only am I very good at it, but I'm always looking for more opportunities to name things.
Doesn't have a name, does it?
No, not really. No. No. So the capital city is called Wickstone. And the reason for that is that when it was first founded, these settlers were traveling across the land and they found this big, have you ever seen Devil's Tower out in, I think it's in Wyoming, right? Out west. It's this big rock that literally looks like somebody grabbed a handful of earth and just stretched it up to the sky like Laffy Taffy, right? It's got these crazy kind of lines. So these settlers were traveling through my world and they found this big stone like that. And up at the top, there was this giant, like kind of glittering cluster of gold and gems and all the, you know, these like rare ores. And in the setting sun, it looked like a bright candle basically standing against the sky. So they said, oh, like the wick of a candle, Wickstone. And that was where the capital city was founded. And it was, you know, able to be paid for based on all of this wealth that they mined from the area. And, you know, it's kind of this beacon of light and hope in the world. And that's sort of what I wanted to build this continent or this world around, this idyllic sort of perfect city, right? This really like classically high fantasy, like elven city, you know, heavenly city, right? Sure. So I kind of refer to the world as, you know, Wickstone or the continent of Wickstone or the world of Wickstone, but I don't have, you know, in the way like Tolkien has Arda or, the Elder Scrolls has Tamriel or whatever. Like, I actually don't really think about it in a bigger sense because I haven't really let the game grow beyond that. I mean, there are certainly larger forces at play, but I kind of wanted to, like, for example, the gods in this world, they have Pelor and they have Obadhai and they have, you know, all the third edition D&D gods, but the god that is kind of the main player in the world doesn't have a name. And the idea that I had for them was that they would basically, you know, in the same way as when you see sometimes in stories, you know, like a supremely advanced alien race will visit humanity and they say, I took the form that would be most acceptable to you, right? I kind of like that idea that a god would say, whoever worships me may have their own name. You know, some people may worship Pelor and some people may worship Saloon and some people, you know, may worship Thor or Isis or Loki or whatever. It's all the same idea, right? It doesn't matter what you call me. I'm there for you either way, which I thought was kind of an interesting concept. And it also allowed me to get out of having to come up with a name for something. So I was kind of killing two deities with one stone there, I think, with two giant glittering stones.
I like to imagine that all of your world building decisions are actually grounded in, do I have to make a name for it or not?
You'd be surprised. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the closest that I had. That's sort of the main identity of this world, I think. And yeah, it allows my players to sort of take what they want out of it a little bit more, I think. They're not really confined to this identity that I've created for them. So I would like to think of myself as a real philanthropist for D&D players. I'm doing them a favor, damn it.
Love it. So then do you have like a specific creation story for the world, or is that just, it's not important to the story, so it doesn't come up?
No, in this world, it really isn't something that's come up. I wanted to get into the world and let my players kind of dig their teeth into it and see if that was a direction that they wanted to go. And it didn't really seem like something that was interesting to them. So, you know, that allowed me to avoid the whole spend 200 hours creating something that my players are never going to hear about problem that so many DMs face. And I've certainly faced that in different worlds of mine. But with this one, it didn't really end up being relevant. I have one player in this game that is tied very closely to the story and the past of this world, but it doesn't go so far back that they're a part of the actual Genesis story of this world.
Sure.
So it wasn't really relevant. Basically, it's a party of five, and one of them is a cleric that in the first session, they found them in like this elaborate sarcophagus, essentially, with symbols of the sun emblazoned all over it. And they cracked open the sarcophagus looking for, obviously, you know, treasure and jewels or whatever. And inside was this perfectly preserved human cleric, and not perfectly preserved in the way that, like, you know, like a mummy is preserved, literally as though they're frozen in time magically, right? And as soon as they open the tomb, this guy wakes up and he has no memory of who he is or where he comes from or anything like that. But the players start noticing after traveling with him for a while, they're finding all this iconography all over the world that looks just like this cleric. And they're like, that's really strange that we're seeing like portraits of this guy that we just found in a box underground somewhere all over the place. Like, is he, you know, is he a god? Is he some ancient vampire? Is he, you know, is he good or evil? He doesn't know who he is. Like, what do we, you know, what do we know? And one of the interesting sort of climaxes, I think, in the story was at one point they're, you know, they've been facing off against this villain, this recurring enemy that they only know as the smooth-skinned man. He's kind of this featureless Plato-like man that he shows up once in a while and he's gotten the better of a few different party members in isolated instances before they all kind of came together. And they snuck into his lair and they found this mirror that could, you know, peer between planes. And one plane they looked into, they saw a crowd of people gathered around and they all looked exactly like this cleric. And so they were kind of like, oh my God, like what's going on here? What, there's more of you somewhere? Like, are all these pictures depictions of you, or is it some other world that these artifacts are kind of seeping into our world from? So I thought that was a really fun thing. And I haven't answered that question for my players yet. So I won't answer it here.
Well, I can at least ask this question. Is this something that you came up with? Like, I guess building this character with a player, it sounds like there's a lot of surprises. Is it surprises for them, surprises for the entire table? Like, where did this concept come from?
Yeah. So he has an idea of what his lineage is, right? But I thought it would be kind of a fun experiment. This is a newer player, so I didn't really want to put the burden of not metagaming on him like too much, right? So I told him, I said, look, I have a lot of ideas about who I want your character to be. Build whatever you want, right? But once you give me this sort of template for who you want to be, I'm going to fill in a lot of gaps and I'm not going to tell you how I'm filling them in. You're going to find out with everybody else. Is that cool with you? Like, does that sound like a fun character to play, that you're kind of rebuilding your identity from nothing, essentially? And he said, heck yeah, that sounds awesome. That sounds really, really cool.
Yeah.
And so this has been a really fun thing. I mean, that reveal for him was like, what? Like that he was really into it. He was like, why are there more of me? I don't understand this. I thought that was a really, really fun thing. And it really pushed them to kind of, you know, seek the answers to this question that now, you know, now 6 years later, they still have no idea.
Jeez. Look at you. So, I thought I drip fed information to my party, but you are 6 years later and you're like, no, we only got more questions. We're lost up in here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I take it as a huge compliment that my players are still engaged in this world. But I should offer the disclaimer that it has been quite a while since we've played in this, because one of our players actually fell very ill, like in real life, and was unable to play for about a year or so. We're actually just picking up the game probably over the summer for the first time in about a year now. So we're really excited to get back into it, because my players were really on the cusp of some of these answers that I know they're, you know, now we're going to go back and they're going to be like, completely oblivious to any of this.
Right,
they're going to have forgotten about all this carefully crafted pyramid of mysteries that I've built for them. It's going to be totally out the window. And, you know, I'm going to drop this answer on them and they're all just going to be like crickets, right? I'm going to be like, you guys, like the guy with one arm who came in through the window in the second session, remember? Like, you don't remember that? Yeah, you're going to be like, I don't know, man. I don't know.
I play weekly and I feel like I run into that where it's like, you know, like when you watch a show and it's like they bring up a character that was in like three seasons back and you're like, why is the last time on talking to me about this character who's, they're going to be in this episode, aren't they? And then absolutely, midway through, they show up. You just got to do that for the next like 6 weeks of just like, hey, you know, just to give you guys a recap of just some handpicked sessions. I don't know why. Like there's this guy and this guy. And
no reason at all for me to remind you of this person's name. Definitely they're not going to be important this week. Right. Trust me. And ignore the fact that you're trying to figure out someone's secret identity. Just like suspend your disbelief for a moment while I remind you of this character you haven't heard about in 2 years.
As a dungeon master, I think that you know, when you build these big stories, because you want to get these big reveals and these big moments that come from player involvement, it's really torturous to ourselves, I feel like, sometimes, where I know I have so many little things where it's just like peppered in and I'll like, you know, throw it into the game and I just sit there and I wait for somebody to react. And then I'm like, Yeah, they'd never get that. There's no reason for them to pick up on like, oh, see, I described him the same as I described that guy from 6 months ago. It's like, they're not going to remember that.
No, of course not. You do have to be a little bit masochistic, I think, to be that kind of DM, right? You really need to be willing to take a risk and say, okay, if they figure this out, if they connect the dots, it's going to be the most satisfying thing ever. But that's only going to happen, you know, 1% of the time, right? Because for the most part, when I play with my players, by the time we get to the end of the session, everybody's like six beers in. So we're all just, you know, we're totally not heads in the game anymore. We're all just goofing around talking about different things, right? So, you know, we have a one of the games that I'm playing in currently, a friend of ours, he runs it. At the beginning of every session, he randomly picks one of the players, one of us, to recap the last session. And if we fail to recap it, he imposes heavy penalties upon us in game. That's, I think, actually kind of an elegant way to, you know what I mean? It's not stuff where he's like, oh, you forgot what happened. You lose a hand or whatever, you know?
Sure. But it's obviously agreed upon. You guys have fun with it. You're fine.
Exactly. You know, he'll suddenly, you know, we'll have a weak roll and he'll reach over and flick our dice and he'll be like, oh, that was a one. That's so funny about that. I didn't realize, it's like silly little things like that where he'll kind
Sure.
Yeah. I actually think that's kind of a clever way to encourage player engagement like that. Like I said, you have to expect that your players aren't necessarily going to connect all the dots, but when they do, oh dear Lord, is that satisfying? I love it. I kind of operate on the rule of threes, right? Like, I won't expect my players to remember anything that I don't either tell them three times or figure anything out that I don't give them at least three hints towards, like three heavy-handed hints towards. We actually had an episode a few months ago where we were designing a starter adventure for new D&D players. And this is something we built it around actually creating a session for some high school friends of Piper's that had never played D&D before. They wanted to try the game out before they were moving out of state. And we said, well, yeah, let's see if we can build an adventure that it engages, you know, all the pillars of D&D, sort of like adventuring, combat, the skill system, you know, role play, like kind of put all of those things into the game. And we made this kind of mystery about someone who was trying to crash a wedding. And there were a couple of different like culprits, potentially the suspects that we posed for them. And every single one, I wanted to create at least three clues that could be, you know, proven either, you know, true clues or false clues essentially. Right. Because any one of them, they could just take the wrong thing from it, you know, take the wrong idea and say, oh, well, we decided for whatever arbitrary reason that this is damning evidence and this is not, when I never intended it to be that way. So you need to kind of give your players backdoors and multiple opportunities to learn things the right way. And when we actually were able to put this session into practice, the players got it like right spot on. And I was really, really happy with that, because I think employing that sort of rule of really like feeding them continual evidence and making sure that you're giving them at least three chances to learn everything that you want them to learn, I think was a really helpful thing.
Yeah. I find that I often will fall into the trap where, because I created it, it's very hard to look at it from the player's perspective. You know, the second that I make something, it is tainted with the fact that I made it and I know how it's supposed to go. So that's something that I've been actually working on myself recently is trying to step into the shoes of the player and say, like, okay, like, what is going to be interesting to them because they don't have all of my information?
Absolutely.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
That was it.
That's okay. That's just the way you said sometimes, absolutely.
Sometimes I just agree with you, Jared, okay? Like, you didn't have to have strings attached, all right?
But you see how you've conditioned me, don't you?
Yeah, yes, I have. Yeah. It's good that you fear me, yes.
So you mentioned this city, this initial city of Wickrock. What was it again?
Wickstone, yeah.
Wickstone. That's pretty close. I'll give it to me.
Yeah.
So of this world, do you have any other major places, or what has become of Wickstone to be such a center of attention to the point that you offhandedly refer to the world by that city?
You know, it was funny. I built this town just saying this world thinking
on rock and roll.
Yeah. Shut your mouth. I built this city, yes, on rock and roll, but much more than that. It was built upon the idea that I wanted there to be, I wanted all of my players to have like one thing that they were all familiar with, right? They,
sure.
No matter where they were from in this world, they would all know, oh, okay, Wickstone is this beautiful city on a hill that we're all familiar with. We all kind of dream of, and anyone can dream of making it big there. You know, there's like, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. It's the Big Apple. It's, you know, it's this kind of this beacon, right? And so I just wanted to build this place that was, it was just simple and easily understood as this good place that everyone wants to get to, right? And the funny thing about it is we've never gone there.
Oh.
In my session, yeah. Early on in the game, and this is maybe one of the pitfalls of giving your players too much freedom, right? Like, I designed this as a very open world kind of game. It was in no way linear whatsoever. The time in which my players are playing in this history, it's kind of after the golden age of Wickstone, right? So about 10 years before our story starts, there was a great war concluded, right? That essentially destroyed the entire continent. And the opening session starts with all of these players. They're sitting around in a tavern. Some of them had worked together before. They'd done kind of odd jobs here and there, but it's the kind of world where there isn't a lot of stability in it. Not a lot of people have like regular day jobs. There's a lot of kind of adventuring parties out there. There's a lot of people who kind of, you know, they come together to do one job and then they, you know, separate and never see each other again, because that's just the way you sort of get by. And they're in this tavern just looking for work, as your average adventurer does. And they find this letter from the king posted on a job board. And he basically says, we're trying to, it was like the New Deal, essentially. They're trying to rebuild Wickstone. All of these castles, all of these once grand keeps that belong to all of our, you know, great lords and ladies and dukes and earls and whatever, they all are scattered across the countryside, abandoned, in disrepair. Any group of individuals who can reclaim one, clear it out of monsters or bandits or whatever, and restore it to its former glory will be recognized as a noble, as a lord with titles in the new Wickstone, basically. And so that was kind of the catalyst that I wanted to give my players to go out into the world and explore and build something, right? I wanted them to help build this world and have them help decide what it would become, right? And so they did this for a few sessions, and then they get an emissary from the king appears, and they say, hey, we have been watching what you've been doing. We're really excited about the work that's been going on in this part of Wickstone. You know, we see that you've taken this run-of-the-mill, run-down, you know, pile of rocks, and you've turned it into a fine functioning castle again. The king requests your presence because he has a problem that he needs your help with. He's fallen ill, and we don't want anyone to know about it. Will you please come and see if you can help the king? And my party was basically just like, nah, no, not interested. It kind of took the back burner to all this other stuff that was sort of going on. It just wasn't something that ever ended up happening. And you know, the reason the king fell ill is because it's the same reason this great war ravaged the countryside. There was actually this curse that was let out into the world, and it started kind of creeping in and corrupting everything. And it was like turning brother against brother, and it caused the great downfall of Wickstone. And there's this big mystery as to where did this curse come from? Who started it? Like, why did this all happen? Because nobody really knows. Nobody has any idea why this war started. A lot of people just think this war went on for decades. It just was always a part of our lives, right?
Right. Generation and generation goes by. You kind of forget the start.
Exactly. And that's kind of the central mystery in this campaign, is what was the purpose of this war? Like, because clearly something wanted this great empire to kind of fall. What, you know, do they want it to fall because there was something wrong with the empire, or because they wanted to take over, or because it was, you know, some being beyond even our understanding, beyond the petty squabbles of mortals in this world, you know? And that was kind of the foundation that I wanted to lay. And again, I wanted to let my players kind of tell me what would be most interesting. Do they want it to just be this, you know, this kind of political intrigue story, or did they want it to be this great eldritch horror that unleashed this upon the earth? And that's, spoilers, the direction that it kind of went with it. So I thought that ended up being a really fun experiment that turned out interesting in ways that I could never have imagined. The first thing that I ever built for the city was the Capitol Wickstone. So in a roundabout way of answering your question, yeah, like that's how I built the city, but my players never actually ended up going there and experiencing that aspect of this world, which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah. And I really love the idea that, let's say, you know, a year down the line, one day you can just have a decree going out that the king's dead, and everyone's just going to look around and be like, oh my God, we forgot. We were supposed to help. That's my favorite thing to do, is take ignored quests and just bring them back up at some point.
Yeah, give them actual consequences. Be like, yeah, remember that lady that asked you to get all the rats out of her basement? Yeah, they ate all her food and she died.
Right. And it, like, you know, a lot of times it's like, oh, that's, you know, punishing the players. It's like, well, no, it's just the world keeps moving. It didn't stop.
Like, the players punished themselves by not doing it.
I do love that approach, though, because a lot of times it can be very difficult to start a campaign and say, you know, this is the direction we want to go. This is the campaign I want to play. Unless it's like a very story-based campaign of, hey, this thing is happening, and you guys get swept up in the, you know, in the event of it. But I like that approach where you just, you said, here's a, you know, cast your tendrils out, see what they grab onto. Yes, that's an Eldritch Horror-esque tie-in. and you know, that's what they latched onto, and you get to run with that now.
Yeah. You know, and I think this approach was kind of born out of necessity, because at the time when I first started this campaign, I had like 8 or 9 people that wanted to play D&D, you know, and none of them were, they were all just individuals who wanted to come play. You know, it wasn't like we had one group of 4 and one group of 5, or, you know, 3 groups of 3 or whatever. It was just, you know, a bunch of people happened to come to me at the same time and were like, I've never really played before, or I haven't played in a while, I want to get back into it. And so I wanted to design a world and a story that could accommodate all of these players and have anyone kind of come in and out, because, you know, I've tried to play with big groups before. It's impossible to wrangle all those people with a regular schedule, right?
Right.
So I wanted to have something where, you know, they'd go and reclaim this keep early on. They would have this base of operations. And then next time we play, let's say only 3 people come, well, you know, that's the party that goes out and does adventures, right? The week after that, maybe 5 people come, then that's the party that goes out and does adventures. So there's this kind of big story that's going on in the world that's being told by my players as much as it's being told by me. And it allows for there to be kind of gaps in the story. You know, they can miss a week or two if they, you know, if they have work or if they have another game or, you know, other obligations, whatever. And they're not really missing out on the story. It's kind of growing in multiple directions at once based on what they want to get out of it. And I thought that was a really, really satisfying thing to get to do.
Yeah, you've basically taken the concept of a West Marches campaign, which is, I mean, entirely what you said of people can miss. You say this, there's going to be a game, whoever can show up, show up. But you've at the same time tied in a larger story to it. It's not just about what the players do. There's still a world going on. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, my inspiration for it actually was from totally outside of D&D. Actually, a source of inspiration that I talk about quite a bit on our podcast, Worldforge Pod, hosted by me and Piper. Please go listen to us on any major podcast platform. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it. It's Final Fantasy Tactics Advance, one of my favorite games of all time. And it's like an isometric turn-based strategy game with a really, really interesting kind of open-ended multi-class progression system. Perfect to talk about on a Monsters and Multi-Class episode, perhaps. There's this mechanic in it where there are like 300 main story missions in the game, or story missions or side missions where you actually go in and you play a map and fight an enemy, right? And then in addition to that, they have what they call dispatch missions, where it's like a side quest that the story of it is basically just like one little sentence, and it's not something that's really big enough for you to have to go and do it yourself. So you pick a couple of members of your party, you send them off and either they're strong enough and they succeed, or they are not strong enough and a week later they come back and they rejoin your group, right? And so you're kind of, in addition to this main story, you're constantly sending off little envoys in different directions. Like, you can just choose which things you think are interesting and valuable to apply your resources to. And I thought it would be really cool to try and find a way to put that into a tabletop gaming world where you could just say, hey, right now there's this main story in front of you, but if you think it's more interesting to send two guys off this way and three guys off this way and four guys off this way, you know, the world grows in the direction that you're looking at.
Right. Right. That's great. And that's, you know, good world building philosophy is, you know, to build the rails in front of players, not so much putting them on rails, but wherever they go with it, you just keep, you know, putting tracks there.
And, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, exactly.
I love doing that, where I'll throw like five hooks at my players and they're like, you know, wow, you prepared five hooks? No, not at all. I prepared one hook.
I just said it was in the direction that you were traveling.
Right.
You know,
right.
It could have been anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah,
That's great. So what are some other interesting locations then that they found? I mean, I assume that each of these strongholds, have they only explored one, or they like explore a couple of those?
No, they've been all over the place. So, I kind of wanted it to have all of the different locations they would go to have this sort of like monster of the week sort of feel.
Sure,
I really
sure.
tried to build every mission out to, you know, some of them were kind of different genres. Like, there were sort of horror themed ones,
yeah.
and there were ones that were more mysteries, and ones that were more like kind of a typical like dungeon crawl, like D&D session. There was one session that I thought was really, really interesting where, one of our players is a lizard man and they don't have really great relations in this world with frogmen. They have kind of this like, yeah, exactly. Like, they eat each other sometimes, you know? And so they found this city of frogmen, and, our lizard man character, we were exploring through this swamp essentially, and they stumbled upon this cabal of frogmen, and they saw us traveling with this lizard man, and they were like, oh my gosh, we've rescued you from this terrible lizard man. He's clearly, you know, coerced you into traveling around with him. And they, you know, they threw a net on him and they dragged him away and they threw him in this fighting arena. And the rest of our party was like, sorry, what? So, you know, they had no idea. So it ended up turning into this really interesting kind of asymmetrical adventure where the party was separated, but only just, right? They
sure.
knew where each other was, and they needed to help each other create a situation where they all would kind of come out on top. You know, they had one goal, which was get our lizard man out of this arena and get away from this swamp with, you know, the original thing we needed. They, you know, they went into a swamp to find some MacGuffin to further the main story, right? And so the character that was trapped in the arena, he's in there with all these other lizard people that are like, oh, we've been stuck in here, forced to fight for their amusement for, you know, for months or years or whatever. And so he's
right.
trying to kind of rally the troops and say, look, we're stronger when we fight together. We have to,
right.
you know, build up these. And everybody that's outside is like, okay, can we set off some fireworks or something to, you know, give him an edge in battle? What kind of magic can we use to help, you know, to distract the enemy from afar? And how can we do this without drawing the ire of these frog people, right? And so
right.
It was this really fun thing that everybody was there was one person that was engaged in like a combat life or death scenario, but the entire party was engaged in this encounter in totally different ways, you know. And I kind of said, look, you all get to pick one task that you're going to accomplish that you think will help get us closer to this goal. Like, I'm going to spend 15 minutes with every single person in the party. You need to give me something that you're going to do to try and bring you closer here. And I was really, really impressed by the things that my players came up with to try and, you know, like, some of them had ideas were like, okay, I'm going to go to a merchant and I'm going to try and buy some like sap and I'm going to throw it into the arena so that when the other guy tries to fight, they're going to get stuck in the sap or whatever. And, you know, and one of them tried to make friends with like a merchant and they said, well, maybe I can buy back our friend, you know, we'll say,
oh, okay.
I run an arena somewhere else. Like, I want to buy this you know, powerful fighting lizard back so that I can go tour all the arenas across the world. And Piper's approach to this was more of a brute force thing, where she said, I'm going to just make a bomb and we're going to throw it into the arena and see if we can just burn down the whole thing. Right. And
yeah.
I thought it was so cool to see all these different approaches. Right. And also, you know, what my players felt comfortable sort of justifying, right? Because I never at any point implied these frog people were evil by any means, you know,
sure.
they were defending themselves. We stumbled into their swamp. They, you know, it was a Shrek and Donkey situation. Classically, we just didn't really, I wanted them to kind of decide where they could go. And it was really, really fun. I thought that was an interesting world. That was actually one of the, I think that one went two or three sessions. That was one of the longer kind of overland adventuring things that we had. Typically, I tried to keep those to one session so that we could keep that episodic, you know, group to group thing going. But I was really happy that one went on as long as it did, because it was very, very fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a blast. And, you know, I love what you're saying about the, like, they don't have the full story. All that your players knew, really, from like a history standpoint, is that this lizard man has been taken and they're not a fan of him. And right there, yeah, they're like, yeah, let's blow him up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, and the actual kind of setting of the swamp was really fun too. Cause I remember as my players were going into it, I drew inspiration from, there's this, if anyone is listening, goes and Google searches, I think they're called bog mummies or bog whites. It was like a real world phenomenon that would happen in places like Scotland, where there's a lot of kind of peaty, sort of swampy soil. When you would bury people, there would be whatever, like the chemical composition of the earth, it would cause their hair to turn like bright red. So they would find these, you know, if you dug them up recently, or if they rose to the surface of the swamp, you know, because it wasn't, they weren't buried deep enough or whatever, they'd come up with bright red hair. And so all of these, as they were traveling through the swamp, they would see just bobbing up and down in the surface of the water, these shocks of bright red hair and little lights under the water. And those are sort of like the little pieces of kind of ambience. They'd see this and be like, what is this? And they'd go, right, and explore. And then this, you know, bright fiery haired kind of demon would jump out and grab them and pull them into the swamp, you know?
I was totally on board until you said, and then they went to explore. Like, what is wrong with them?
That's how games work, Jared.
Not when you value your life, all right? You
yes,
see
of course,
the terrifying, bobbing, red-haired creatures, and you go, wow, let's leave that alone.
Yeah, of course, of course. Maybe a smarter call than some of my players made, but more interesting? You decide, listeners.
Yeah, I guess they went out there. So, sadly, we are approaching our end of our time here, but before I end things, I like to turn it over to you, and this can be whatever you want to talk about. Is there anything, be it about your world or outside of that, D&D in general, that you would want to spend some time talking about?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't even, you kind of joked with me before this, but I didn't get to spend any time talking about my big inspirations, Tolkien or Miyazaki or Dark, you know, any of that stuff. Like, it's all Dark Souls and Tolkien is kind of the a weird, like, tonal combination in a lot of ways, honestly. But, you know, those are the three pillars of my world building are,
I love it,
Hayao Miyazaki, Hidetaka Miyazaki of Dark Souls, and Tolkien, my number one ride or die. So if you want to hear me just run my mouth about any of those things, I mean, my show is the place to come for that. Pretty much everything I build, just stolen, like, you know, whole cloth from the sails of their ships. I love everything Tolkien, Miyazaki.
Okay, so I'm gonna do a rapid fire round then. Okay,
yeah, give me
so
one.
for each of these inspirations, you tell me one thing that you just first thing that comes to mind that you stole from them.
Oh, okay. Oh man.
All right. So we're gonna start with Dark Souls.
Dark Souls.
What have you stole from Dark Souls?
You know, Dark Souls, actually, the idea of the curse of the undead as this sort of, this great curse that kind of covers everything and it sort of saps the life from the world. I don't want to go too much into this because again, this gets at the mystery that my players have not solved yet.
It's rapid fire round. You're good.
But the nature of this curse that exists in my world is very much similar to the curse of the undead in Dark Souls, that basically there is a being that the curse in my player's world, it is this being seeping into our plane through like cracks between the planes. And when you succumb to this curse, it basically is feeding energy back to that powerful being. And there are individuals in this world that, you know, they never quite die. In that same way as Dark Souls, where you kind of die over and over and over again, they're always kept just on the brink of death so they can continue feeding energy to this powerful being in the other plane. That was something that was really that really intense kind of dark, like, ooh, whoa, that was something that I pulled from Dark Souls.
I love it. I'm stealing that.
Way back in the day, yeah.
It's a great application of it. Yes. Okay, so next, I'm going to get a little bit more specific because I know you. From Miyazaki movies, Studio Ghibli movies, whatever you want to say, what have you stolen from Princess Mononoke?
You know what's funny about it, actually? There was a collaborative thieving, a Miyazaki heist between my brother and myself, because the character that he played is basically Princess Ashitaka. So this is kind of a funny story. I've told this on my podcast before, but I know that in spite of the fact that I designed this game to accommodate my players kind of jumping in and out, and you know, one session they can make it, another session they can't. I had plans for my brother's character. He showed up probably a year or two into the game. So our group had been playing for quite a while. They were pretty well established. They were familiar with the story that was going on. And he shows up as this weird guy who the curse that they've been trying to fight for years is trapped inside of his arm. You know, he started succumbing to this curse, but he stopped it in his arm, just like Prince Ashitaka, right? Unlike Prince Ashitaka, his arm didn't have quite the happy ending that that we see in the Miyazaki film, because they at first were really not trusting of him because they really had no reason to be. They'd seen this curse as something that was only evil. It had only brought about kind of the downfall of those they cared about and had been acting against them all the way through the story. He was able to kind of win their trust, but after he wasn't able to make it to a few sessions, and I really wanted to push the main story forward. So one night our players, they stumbled into his room because they heard a strange sound, like someone like chanting or muttering. And they saw him standing over the bed of our cleric, Redis, the one who has, you know, doppelgangers all throughout history or whatever. He was just standing over him, you know, chanting some strange tongue that none of them knew. And they were like, okay, that's really weird. What's going on here? We should put a stop to this probably. So they're trying to shake him awake. And as they're shaking him awake, suddenly their keep is attacked. And the curse on his arm flares up. It starts creeping throughout the rest of his body. And they're all just like, we don't really know what to do. We've been trying to stop this curse from taking him out. So they just strap him down and cut his arm off. And the next time he comes to session, we're all like, all right, so here's the thing.
Good news and bad news. Good news and bad news. What do you want first?
You're alive, number one. So you're welcome for that. We could have gone a very different route with this one for you. But he was an archer who suddenly just only had one arm. And I wasn't trying to punish him for not showing up.
Sure.
If he had not been as away from the game as he was, it's something that I probably would have worked out more with him. But I ended up deciding it would be a fun thing for him to suddenly say, oh, they've kind of taken away my main power, right? He lost this arm that, you know, previously they saw as, you know, maybe it's a clue towards how to stop this curse because the curse stopped spreading from his arm, right? But it ended up turning into a different kind of a plot hook because he lost this arm and, you know, Piper, her character said, you know, I come from a town of mechanics and they've done incredible things with prosthetics. If we go to my hometown again, where she has all kinds of family baggage that I wanted to explore anyway, I know an incredibly talented blacksmith that could make possibly a surrogate arm, a prosthetic arm for you that could be just as nimble and dexterous as the arm that you had. And you know, we could make it stronger and we could make it resistant to certain things and we could infuse it with magic. And so it turned into sort of a separate little side quest for them that I thought was really, really fun.
That's
so
awesome.
That was directly inspired by Prince Ashitaka and his cursed arm. Yeah.
I love it. To answer that back, what I have stolen from Princess Mononoke is 100% the boar at the beginning, which I'm terrible with names.
Akoto is, it's not Akoto. Akoto is the big one that's the leader of all the boars, is it?
I think so, yeah. But the I'll just say that general, the first one that comes up, the cursed boar, and the writhing tentacles all around it. Stole that, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And also the entire scene of when the forest spirit is first found, completely took that as like a lawful spirit of the forest that visited my party at one point. And I think somebody even said like, this is just ripped from Princess Mononoke. And I said, isn't it awesome? Like,
you're damn right. It is.
Isn't it worth doing twice? Like, come on.
Yeah. we talked about this recently on our show that, obviously Spirited Away won Best Animated Picture and is an incredible film, like an incredible feat breaking into, you know, Western audiences and being as accessible as it was for Western audiences. Like, I think that's really, it's amazing what it did.
Yeah.
I definitely view Princess Mononoke as his masterpiece. That's far and away my favorite movie of his. I think that movie is so beautiful.
I'm with you. And that's one of the reasons I brought it up, because I listened to that episode and I heard you say that and I was like sitting there cutting the grass and I'm like, oh yeah, he's right. we got one more left. And this is probably going to be a hard one. Lord of the Rings, what did you steal from the Tolkien universe? And I feel
literally
like the answer is
everything else.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yep. Credits roll. No, you know what? I've had characters that are inspired by, the Children of Húrin is one of my favorite works of Tolkien. It's everything that Tolkien does is attached to some type of language or culture or, you know, like a people that he had studied in his career as an academic, right? So the Riders of Rohan are meant to be like kind of the prototypical like Viking race, you know, these big kind of strong warrior men who are noble in their demeanor and their, you know, their the warrior culture, right? And then, you know, the elves are kind of this more fantastical sort of Arthurian kind of like all of these things that he has are based on things that he has studied, right, throughout his career. And I love this use of tropes that he kind of establishes, I think, as kind of the prototypical, like, fantasy trope generator, right? He brought all of these tropes to the world, right? And he made them sort of accessible to people. And the Children of Húrin is one of my favorite stories of his because it is his attempt, essentially, at recreating, like, a Viking epic. It's very much like the sagas of the Vikings and the Norse gods, and it just has this gravity to it that a lot of Tolkien's other work, you know, has, but you have to dig a little bit deeper for.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Every single character in The Children of Húrin is like, that's the most badass motherfucker I've ever met in my life. Like, there isn't a single character that you would ever be worried about, you know, having a hard time, like, alone in a dark alley, right? They all can, like, take care of themselves. They're all so cool. But there's one character in particular from The Children of Húrin, Glaurung, the great dragon, who is basically, like, the father of all terrestrial dragons. He was the first great, land dragon, but, like, the greatest dragon that couldn't fly, essentially. And while he didn't have the power of flight, which is obviously sort of a staple for dragons, he made up for it in so many ways by being kind of this magical trickster, right? Which I think is a more interesting angle than he's not just powerful because of his brute force, which he does have. He's gigantic. You know, he makes Smaug look like a little salamander, right? But he can curse you just by muttering your name, right? He can say, Turin Turambar, I curse you to forget everything you've ever known and wander aimlessly for the rest of your life. You know, like he puts on these kind of ancient epic curses like that. It's not him casting a spell. It's him just knowing your true name and having dominion over you, which I think is really, really cool. And that's kind of what I've based again, a little bit of spoilers for if any of my players are listening to this. That's kind of what I've based this sort of elder god character that is the curse is the manifestation of them seeping into our world off of Glaurung. One of the coolest characters in fantasy literature, like full stop, in my opinion.
That's awesome. And one day I'll have to have you come back, like after, I won't say after the campaign's done, because this sounds like the type of campaign that doesn't have an end. It took you 6 years to drip feed some information. But, you know, love to have some of those questions answered, because you have successfully wowed me with your world building, which is what I wanted from this. So
awesome.
We'll kind of taper off here. Thank you so much, Sam, for joining. This was everything I wanted it to be, but not long enough. I wish you didn't have time constraints, but the world is a cruel mistress.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy to have been here. I really love getting to show up on Monks and Monasteries. Is that the name of the show? I don't remember.
I don't either, man.
Okay.
it's not important.
No, seriously, this is so much fun. I always love getting to collaborate with you, and this is, you know, any opportunity to run my mouth for an hour and a half is more than welcome in my book.
And where can others find you to hear you running your mouth for even longer?
Yeah, absolutely. If you are not sick of me by this point, you can find me most often on Twitter at WorldForgePod. That is the best place to find all of the stuff that we do in the tabletop role-playing world. You know, we talk about our show there, of course, every week, but we also do a lot of kind of world building and interacting, and, you know, we share stuff that our friends are working on, all the other creators that we love to collaborate with. I like to think of our feed as a pretty cool resource for people who are looking for a little bit of inspiration, or looking for just something else to kind of to push the boundaries of how you build. Because we really want to help everybody out there build bigger and better. We're really, really passionate about just storytelling in general. And I think seeing different perspectives and being introduced to different things is one of the best things you can do as a creator of any kind. So we try as much as we can to bring that to our feed as much as possible. So World Forge Pod on Twitter. If you want to listen to our show, we're on all major podcast platforms. That is just at World Forge or World Forge Podcast. And if you want to reach out to me with something a little lengthier than a tweet, you can contact me at worldforgepod@gmail.com. We love taking fan feedback. If you have fan fiction or fan art or fan mail or anything like that, we like to keep that open to everybody. If you have suggestions for things you want to hear us talk about on the air, if you want us to do a whole episode talking about Glaurung and how badass he is, send me an email about it and I'll do it. I'd be more than happy to find an excuse to do that. So those are all the places we can be found.
It'd be the first World Forge solo episode as Piper's just and you're like, no, hold on, I got another thing.
I'm going to take a nap for this one, Sam. You just go on,
And, you know, I said it at the beginning, but I'll say it again. I highly, highly recommend them. If you're looking for a place to start, a recent episode was the one around gardens, and I was in love with it. It was great. It was great inspiration, and I've been racking my brain for the last, like, couple days, whatever week now, just thinking about who could have a garden. I've got somebody else who's like going to be starting building one, because it's just like, yes, this, it's so much personality, like, yes, I want this. So
thank you.
Go listen to that episode. If you are not yet, make sure to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, and I don't know, leave 5-star reviews. Everything that Sam said for World Forge, do it for us. You can find us at monsters_multi. And if you are in the market for some new dice, you can go ahead and check out our affiliates, Metallic Dice Games, and get 10% off your order using the code MM10. And you can help out the show. Yeah, you didn't know that you were here with the big boys. We got affiliates.
No, that's pretty spicy, my man. Yeah, we're trying to get that Bezos cash. We want to get an Amazon affiliate link, and it's not happening yet.
So. All right, thank you everyone for listening, and thank you once again, Sam, for joining. I hope we can do this again in some fashion.
Of course, anytime. I love to be here. So thank you again. Bye, listeners. I love you.
You just met him.
Well, I love them. What do you want?